Honorable Court resumes its session.
Thank you. Please be seated. Cece, we're having a little trouble with the audio. Could you turn it up just a bit? Okay, great. Thank you very much. Great. We're back on record. The next case on the calendar is 21-35209, United States of America versus Boyd. Counsel, we can see both of you. Can you hear us? Yes? Okay. We're ready for your argument, and we'll let you know if we have any trouble on our end. We've had a little bit of difficulty with the sound being, we can hear everybody. It's just a little bit muddy is the best word I have for it. So you may want to speak just a little slower than normal.
Very good, Your Honor. Let me know if I need to slow it down. Good morning. My name is Colin Stevens. I represent the appellant, Gregory Boyd. May it please the court. In the original trial in Mr. Boyd's case, the government used testimony from three cooperating witnesses to testify about 404B evidence. The purpose of that evidence was to bolster the case that Boyd knew there were drugs in the car at the time he was stopped, and that formed the basis of the trial that he was facing. Excuse me. Those three witnesses were absolutely critical to the government's case. The government presented these witnesses essentially to show that Boyd was not only possessed drugs on that day, but that he must have known he possessed drugs on that day because of this chain of inference that of his interactions with a gentleman named Fritz Anderson. And essentially these witnesses, at least two of the three of them, portrayed Mr. Boyd as, at least on occasion, acting as the bag man for Mr. Anderson. The 404B instruction was read, but the evidence itself was somewhat tenuous to the offenses of conviction. But what the government did, as I indicated, is it forged this chain of inference between what Mr. Boyd was charged with and what Mr. Boyd was alleged to have done by the testimony of these three 404B witnesses. Later, it turns out that the government did not disclose impeachment evidence pertaining to those three witnesses. In relation to a letter that went out by the U.S. Attorney's Office to a good many defendants in the District of Montana. It was reviewed that the government had withheld evidence relating to these three witnesses, and that, in fact, was a Brady-Giglio violation. The district court in this case erred when it applied 2255H1 to the facts of this petition, rather than the traditional Brady analysis.
Counsel, could we start there? May I forgive me for interrupting, but what if we didn't apply a heightened standard? What's your best shot at a Brady claim? What I'm going to call a vanilla Brady claim. What's your best shot?
And that's fine. The best evidence to establish the materiality of the Brady claim really is the evidence against witness C. That is, to me, the monumental one. So you have this recording of witness C, who is frantically trying to get a substantial amount of time off of his sentence. 50% is a lot of time. And so he's running through sort of, who can I get? And his girlfriend says, well, let's get the black guy or something along these lines.
May I interrupt you? We understand the facts. And I'm for my hypothetical, I'm going to give you that that's exculpatory because he was trying to come up with somebody to save himself, basically, as you've described. I'm going to give you that that's exculpatory. It should have been turned over. So what's your best shot on materiality, please?
The materiality is that his desperation to save himself and his inability to come up with more than one black guy beyond Nate, what that does is it supports just his overall inability to not correctly identify Greg Boyd at trial. It significantly undermines his credibility, and the district court concluded that.
That's why it's exculpatory, and that's why it should have been turned over, and I'm trying to get to materiality. What's your best shot that the outcome would have differed, sir? Because my understanding is that your client's defense was, as you said, he had to convince the jury that he didn't know what was in the trunk. And he testified himself, right? And as the trial court noted, there were three in particular, there were more than three, but three that I thought instances that I found significant where the prosecutor is pretty effective at undermining his credibility. I want to make sure you have a fair shot at responding to those, because I think that makes the materiality prong of Brady really tough for you.
I guess I disagree. Defense counsel did an amazing job of impeaching all of the witnesses, including these three. And I guess where we get to materiality is there is a reasonable probability that the result would have been different, is that at the point you come to sever this chain of inference that, in my opinion, tips the scale of the credibility of the government's case. You have one thumbprint on the handle of the footlocker bag, and you have Mr. Boyd, who is also, you know, effectively impeached, but you have these three other witnesses who are also effectively impeached. You have the defense investigator who comes in and says, witness C could not identify Mr. Boyd. And then on rebuttal, witness C comes in and says, no, the investigator is essentially lying to you. Here's what really happened. And the materiality is essentially, if the jury no longer believes that these three witnesses are credible, it severs the inferential chain and supports Boyd's contention that he did not know that the drugs were not only in the trunk, but were within two containers in the trunk.
So, counsel, with respect to witness C, did witness C say anything about the drugs in the trunk?
He did not, no.
Okay. Did he say anything about Boyd in particular that would lead one to believe that Boyd didn't know that there were drugs in the trunk? I mean, how far does this chain of causality have to go between witness C and your client?
Well, Your Honor, I guess if I'm understanding your question, the answer to your question comes in AUSA Sikora's final portion of his closing, where he's talking about his hypothetical granddaughter and how all of these inferences connect to Mr. Boyd, and how it's really so simple that his granddaughter could understand it. And I guess, Your Honor, at that point, I'm not sure how far it needs to be or how attenuated, but it's the fact that the government is using this to create that chain of inference. And frankly, I don't think it's very far. Witness C and the other two witnesses, the government's case is essentially, well, he must know that drugs are in the car because here's three people who connect him to Fritz Anderson. Fritz Anderson's a drug dealer, and therefore Mr. Boyd must know about all drugs that are anywhere in Billings, Montana, including his car. So I think it is a chain of inference, but it's not very long, especially the way that the government used it at trial.
Your client did have some contact with Boyd, right? He said that he paid him $76,000 in cash in a hotel room. Is that correct?
So yes, Your Honor, except my client is Boyd. Witness C testified that my client received $76,000 from witness C that was destined for Mr. Anderson.
Okay. So is it your contention that the evidence that was withheld would have undermined C's testimony about the $76,000 in the hotel room?
Absolutely. It was Boyd's contention that never happened. And in fact, what the evidence showed at trial was, I believe witness C's testimony was that this 70 some thousand dollar exchange occurred at a very specific hotel in Billings. During the trial, defense counsel produced witnesses to indicate that not only was witness C, who had testified, he registered the room in his name, he did not rent a room at that hotel in that month, let alone on the day that he proclaims that he paid Mr. Boyd this money for Mr. Anderson.
But counsel, the three witnesses we're talking about didn't strike me as very strong government witnesses in the first place. It seems like Boyd's brother would have had a much bigger problem with these witnesses than Boyd. I just want to give you a chance to respond to my concern that his defense was he had to convince the jury he didn't know what was in the trunk. Did he? First of all, am I right about that, or did he have a different defense that he ran at trial? Any other defense?
From my reading of the trial transcript, Your Honor, if you're going to pare it down, his defense was, I did not know.
Right, and he testified. And so,
he did.
And so it seems to me that even if they agreed with you that all three of those witnesses weren't credible, or they didn't know what they're talking about, or maybe even that they were fibbing to get some benefit for their own selves, the jury, I think, saw the defendant testified that he said he hadn't seen the car he bought for his friend since the day he bought it, but they showed proof that he had been ticketed for speeding. Yes? Correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So they got caught up there. And that the one I'm... then there's at ER 456, 457, he says he's never been accused of possessing firearms. He was asked that question. He said no, he had not. There's the transcript shows that the prosecutor showed him a document. I can't tell from the transcript what that document is, but his response audibly into the record was those charges were dropped, and then at 457 he agrees he had been charged with possession of firearm in 2002. Do I understand that right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, yes.
So he concedes to that point. The one I'm a little bit shakier on is him denying drug use, and then the government brought in one of the nurses because, of course, he went into cardiac arrest that night. And the toxicology, seems to be the toxicology we've got shows that it was consistent with either meth or ecstasy. So was the question that he denied use of methamphetamine, or what did he deny in front of the jury?
Well, it got a little tricky. I believe his testimony was that there was meth in his bloodstream, but he did not use it. Don't dispute that
tricky,
Mr. Boyd.
Sure. So, but the jury heard all that, right?
Correct.
Okay, so I'm not trying to give you a hard time. I'm really sincerely interested. We take Brady allegations very seriously, and certainly this one where the government has had to come forward and do, I think, its duty to reveal that there's been this problem. So you have got our full attention. But given this cross-examination, it seems to me that even if all of this had been turned over, even if the jury decided that those other witnesses didn't know what they were talking about at all, how can you show materiality for purposes of Brady?
Because materiality, I think, has to be viewed within the totality of the record, right? I mean, you've got, if the focus is solely on three instances of impeachment where Mr. Boyd was effectively impeached on somewhat collateral matters, right? He was not impeached on his knowledge of the drugs in the car. That's where these three witnesses come in, and that's why it's material within the total record. Three instances where Mr. Boyd may have tacked a little too close to the wind on the truth is not sufficient within the totality of the record to undermine the materiality that, but for Mr. Sikora's withholding of this evidence, that this causal chain that he used to tip the scale was material to the overall trial record in this case.
What does the undisclosed phone call, the jail phone call, contribute to the assessment of witness C's credibility?
Absolutely.
Tell me.
Again, I think it goes back to his desperation not only to come up with names, his understanding of how the cooperation process works, and his inability to come up with more than, quote, one black guy beyond some individual named Nate.
But he didn't name Boyd in that call, did he?
He did not, no. But what he did was, the fact that he didn't name Boyd is what speaks volumes, Your Honor. He wants as many people, he wants to climb this ladder as much as he can, and he does not grasp the ring that is Boyd. To me, that's that is something that a jury should be allowed to consider.
Counsel,
when evaluating.
Forgive me for interrupting, but when you're answering Judge Selna's question, could you factor in that, or maybe you are? The district court agreed with you on this point. She said they wouldn't have believed this witness if they had heard that testimony, right?
That's correct.
Right. So that's what she's assuming it should have been, the recording should have been turned over for this very reason that Judge Selna is pointing out. But where does it get you?
I think what it does is it gets me to materiality under Brady. The underlying issue in the case is that the district court said, okay, I mean, the district court does not use the word material, but essentially what she says is no reasonable juror or few reasonable jurors would have believed witness C. But under 2255H1, I can't use the Brady standard. I have to use the actual innocence standard of 2255H1. And so I'm just going to reserve a little bit of my time if that's all right.
Sure.
Thank you.
We'll hear from opposing counsel, please, from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Tim Tatarka of the District of Montana on behalf of the United States. I'll go right to the issue of materiality. We do think 22H1 is the proper standard under this court's precedence, but this is probably a prime case like the related case of United States versus Maldonado, where there is some materiality under either either standard. And I'll go directly to even the United States. We have presented our arguments for why we don't believe that.
Counsel, could I get you to stop? There's a little bit of a delay in your microphone for some reason, or in the transmission. So if you can slow down a little bit, I think we'll have a better time. We can hear you. You're loud enough.
Sure.
But if you could just slow it down a little bit, then I think we won't lose anything.
Sure. My apologies, Your Honor. I'll go directly to the materiality with respect to witness C. We don't think this is this is appropriate, but even if this court were to throw out witness C's testimony entirely, say he was entirely incredible, it would not change the affect the reasonable make a reasonable probability of a difference in this case. As the court noted, the primary evidence here is undisputed. The evidence that there was a distribution amount of guns and drugs in Mr. Boyd's possession, in the car that he owned and was driving. So in order to get around that, he had to show that despite possessing it, he didn't know it was in the trunk of that car. Without even getting to the witnesses, the cooperating witnesses, there were all of the problems with Mr. Boyd's testimony, which Judge Kristen walked through. And then in addition to that, there were the two cooperating witnesses that for which there was no, the court didn't find there to be any withheld impeaching evidence. Witness A, like witness C, testified that Boyd collected drug debts, attempted to collect a drug debt for Mr. Anderson. Witness A didn't suffer from the same problem that witness C did, in that he knew both Boyd and Anderson well, so there wasn't this identification problem. With respect to witness B, she testified directly to the fact that Boyd was bragging about bringing drugs up from California, as well as the connection between Boyd and Anderson and Lacey Jackson, which increases the inculpatory nature of the drug ledger that was found on Mr. Boyd. And I would note that the third piece of evidence that the court presumed was favorable and not disclosed related to hearsay with respect to Ms. Jackson, the district court expressly found that that made no difference, even within the testimony, no significant difference, even within the testimony of Witness B, because Witness B testified of her own knowledge that Jackson was dealing the drugs. And there was no hearsay issue with respect to her statements with respect to Boyd. Boyd bragging about the bringing the drugs in. So even at the lower level of materiality, even throwing out witnesses' testimony entirely, as Judge Kristen pointed out, there was significant amount of impeaching evidence with respect to Witness C in the first place. So we're talking about the marginal difference between what was presented in impeachment and what could have been. There's just no reasonable probability of reaching a different result. And that's with respect to the Brady materiality standard. We think that's sufficient for the court to resolve this case. But we do believe that the district court here applied the proper standard of the 2255H1. I'm happy to go into that if the court...
Maybe just quickly, the district court relied on Brown, I think, and you filed a 28J letter suggesting that Lopez may be the 2255 appropriate standard. Do you want to speak to that?
Well, Lopez predates Brown. Lopez stands for the proposition that a non-material Brady claim is not... doesn't meet the has to meet the 2255H1 standard and doesn't. It left open the question of whether a meritorious Brady claim would face the same problem. Brown answers that question.
Well, Brown answers that for a 2254 claim where there's a state collateral procedure available. Different situation, sure. In 2255 where there is no other safety net, what I'm going to call a safety net. So I'm wondering why we would reach Brown here when we have published authority from the Ninth Circuit in the form of Lopez. But I want to give you a chance to both of you a chance to answer that.
I think you only reach the question of Brown if you find that there is a material Brady violation. And so I agree with you. You don't need to reach it here. But if you found that there was a material Brady violation, you would be in a box where you would have to apply Brown. And I do think Brown is controlling here. And the best evidence of that is not only the fact that the court did apply it in the non-precedential case of Bowser, but you can look to the 11th Circuit case of Scott, which is actually the most favorable, sympathetic case to Boyd's position. But they were in a similar position where they said that there was existing circuit precedent with respect to 2254, even though in that case, Scott disagreed with it. They said, but we can't, there's no principal distinction between applying it with respect, what is a second and successive petition at the state level versus the federal level.
But the 11th Circuit case goes significantly farther than we've gone, right? Doesn't it say that all subsequently filed petitions are necessarily SOS or just about? That would be new law for us too, I think, counsel. That's what I'm trying to get at. Do you agree?
New law with respect to 2255?
I'm asking whether, to make it easier for you, because I didn't ask a good question, don't you agree that if we were to adopt the 11th Circuit's holding, we would be expanding our own rule? It goes farther than we've gone, right?
I think it would be new law in that it would say in a published position that Brown applies to 2255s.
Okay.
But I think the 11th Circuit was in the same position there, where it had a rule precedent with respect to 2254 saying Brady claims were second and successive, and felt obligated to apply that to the 2255 context.
Let me just check with my colleagues to see if they have any more questions. Nope, I don't think so. Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, I think you have, could you put a minute on the clock, please? Go right ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to deal with your most immediate question about the 11th Circuit's decision and whether adopting that would make new law in this circuit, I think not only would, if the court adopts the 11th Circuit's rationale, not only would it be creating new law, I think it would be contrary to footnote number 5 in the Brown decision, where it does, that note leaves open sort of the question of whether a Brady claim that's discovered after a petitioner filed his first petition would be an actual second or subsequent under the Panetti rationale. I guess to address the government's reliance on Maldonado, I was counsel in Maldonado's case. I think it's factually distinguishable from Mr. Boyd's case. In that case, as the court noted in the memorandum decision, the Brady evidence dealt with one witness who was cumulative, and I will end my argument there.
All right. Thank you both for your argument. We'll take this case under advisement. That's the, is that the last case on the calendar for the day?
No, one more.
One more. I beg your pardon. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.